This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to the Massachusetts State House News Service, providing our listeners with high-quality, comprehensive, objective information about the activities of our state government. Today, we are covering the week of April 20th through 26th, 2026. This program is sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Before the Republican Party convention slowed to a crawl during voting for the top of the ticket late Saturday afternoon, Republican delegates officially nominated three candidates for statewide seats by acclamation because they faced no intra-party opposition: John Deaton for U.S. Senate, Elizabeth Dion for Treasurer, and Michael Walsh for Attorney General. "We are rebuilding the Massachusetts Republican Party from the ground up, competing and winning its seats on school districts, boards of health, and select boards. We are reaching out to younger voters, minority populations, independents, and disaffected Democrats who share our values," Mass GOP Chair Amy Carnival said, kicking off the party convention at Worcester's DCU Center. By the afternoon, delegates grew restless as the convention ran behind schedule and voting for lieutenant governor remained open for longer than anticipated. The announcement of votes cast by county and the endorsement of candidate for lieutenant governor ended just after 4:30 p.m., Gubernatorial candidates Brian Shortsleeve, Mike Keneally, and Mike Minogue had not yet spoken to the convention, and voting in that contest had not begun. "You see this work represented here today in our candidates. All are welcome as we expend the tents of the Mass GOP," Carnival continued in her morning remarks. "While we have been building our bench, hard-line Democrats who rule Beacon Hill behind closed doors with secrecy and too often an iron fist continue to ignore average citizens who are struggling to get by." Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr of Gloucester and Grafton Representative David Meridian co-chaired the convention, where almost 2,400 delegates registered to participate, according to the party. Deaton, a Marine veteran and attorney, earned the party's endorsement unusually early in November, and on Saturday accepted the nomination as the GOP's candidate for U.S. Senate. He lost his last run for the U.S. Senate to Elizabeth Warren in 2024. And in the fall, will face the victor of a Democratic primary that includes incumbent Senator Edward Markey, U.S. Representative Seth Moulton, and Alex Ricklin. "I'm not running to push the ideology on anyone. People aren't looking for ideology. They're looking for someone to help solve their problems," Deaton told a rowdy crowd. The news service caught up with Deaton during the convention. He noted, "Earning the party's endorsement early allows him more time to get his message to voters, particularly independents and disenfranchised Democrats," he said. "We've got a one-party rule here for a long time. Give somebody else a shot," Deaton said, adding that single-party rule leads to arrogance and corruption and people believing they don't have to answer and be accountable to the people they serve. If sent to Washington, D.C., which is currently controlled by Republicans, Deaton said he'd work outside the supermajority to advocate for Massachusetts residents. He has also been open about not voting for fellow Republicans across the country. "I don't care who the president is, because I'm going to do that simple test. Is it good in Massachusetts, in America? If it is, I support it. If it isn't, I don't support it," Deaton said. Dion, attorney and former chair of the Belmont Select Board, spent much of her time on the convention stage railing current treasurer Deb Goldberg, who is running for a fourth term. "Incumbent Deb Goldberg has failed us. It is time to clean up her cronyism, chaos, and corruption," she said. "She is so unpopular in her own party," Dion said of Goldberg. "I have Democrats gathering signatures for me right now. They want her out. This is a winnable race because it's not partisan. Who's going to argue with running a clean, transparent office that returns more money to cities and towns? As a local official, we're dying from lack of local aid." A spokesperson for Goldberg did not immediately respond to the news service's request for a response to Dion's comment. To a cheering crowd, Dion said her first act as treasurer would be auditing all 12 departments within the Treasury. Dion also said she would work to send more local aid to municipalities in the face of the state's affordability crisis. In the same way that Diana DeSoglio has raised people's understanding of the auditor and how important that is, "I'm doing the same thing for the treasurer's office," Dion added. Linfield lawyer Michael Walsh also earned the nomination for Attorney General and is expected to face incumbent Democrat Andrea Campbell in the fall. Walsh has been involved with the ongoing dispute of the 2024 voter law that enabled the state auditor to audit the legislature. Incumbent Auditor Diana DiZoglio, a Democrat, has been feuding with Campbell over implementation of the voter-approved law since 72% of voters passed it in 2024. The two Democrats have been tied up in a legal battle for months, and DiZoglio has garnered bipartisan support for her efforts to implement the audit. "I'm mad as hell that we don't have an audit, and I think you are too," Walsh said during his convention speech. "I will be a people's lawyer. We will wage a ruthless war on fraud and waste and abuse, starting with that audit." There are no Republican candidates for Secretary of State or State Auditor. As House Ways and Means Chair Aaron Mitchlewitz goes through more than 1,700 amendments to his budget plan, and Senate Ways and Means Chair Michael Rodriguez is deep in the throes of preparing his, the two kicked off official negotiations Thursday on a separate $1.8 billion supplemental spending bill. Conferees will have to determine how they want to split $1.3 billion in surplus income surtax funds between education and transportation, and whether their final bill will touch federal tax policy or FIFA World Cup funding. Budget chairs said they have no non-negotiables heading into conference talks. Flanked also by Senator Patrick O'Connor and Representatives Kip Diggs and Ken Sweezy, Mitchlewitz said he's looking forward to trying to get this done in a quick fashion while we're in the middle of doing all this other stuff. Rodriguez quipped that we're very good at multitasking. He and Mitchlewitz have led numerous conference committees together and are gearing up to pull together their eighth state budget. The supplemental spending bill represents the completion of the second cycle of surtax revenue implementation, Mitchlewitz noted. The first two times lawmakers have gone through the process, we were much more conservative in our approach in relation to how we were setting the budget initially on this, he said. That has left lawmakers with billions of dollars to dole out in supplemental budgets. Even the most staunchest supporter of this original amendment back in 22 did not project it was going to be this high in terms of where the revenue was coming in, Mitchlewitz continued. We have started that process through the last budget, and we will continue to do it in this budget via our consensus revenue agreements to get a little bit closer to a more normalized number, and hopefully we'll have a more stabilized number going forward in the long term. Both bills allocate more funding to the transportation than education, though the House bill would shuttle $740 million to the MBTA compared to $535 million in the Senate bill. Rodriguez, who unlike Mitchlewitz does not represent part of the T's core system, said the differential is due to the Senate's focus on regional equity via funding for regional transit authorities and municipal snow and ice deficits and road repairs. Tax code changes in President Donald Trump's July 2025 budget will also be on the discussion table, as both branches took a step to blunt the estimated $400 million state revenue shortfall that could result from state conformity with the federal tax cuts. The Senate voted to delay implementation to allow for a more gradual adjustment. The House did the same, but with the added condition that the state would permanently decouple from those parts of the federal tax code if voters this November elect to lower the state income tax rate from 5% to 4%. The conference committee will have to determine which approach to follow. House Speaker Ron Mariano said recently that the House is open to negotiating with proponents of the income tax cut question, warning of major program cuts that should it pass. Asked if he is similarly open to negotiations with proponents, Rodriguez said, "Yeah, we're always open to conversations, and that's what we do. We have conversations." Asked if the House has started having those conversations with proponents, Mitchlewitz said, "To be honest with you, it's hard to decide who is actually the person to be talking to, or who you're supposed to be actually negotiating with on this." What the speaker said 2 weeks ago at the chamber breakfast, I think, spoke to our openness and willingness to have conversations with the overall business community about what is the right direction we should be taking in terms of growing our economy, Mitchlewitz said. We have an opinion that, and I think many of us share the opinion here, that lowering the income tax is not the direction we should be going. But we don't necessarily know exactly what is the 100% direct answer that it should be, and we want to have conversations. We want to be open in those to new ideas and to new options, the North End Democrat continued. Asked how comfortable he is in spending billions with a supplemental budget with fiscal storm clouds looming, Rodriguez cited comfort with the fiscal 2027 consensus revenue number, which he said they intend to responsibly live within. State officials agreed in January to build their budgets on the estimate that Massachusetts will collect $44.9 billion in tax revenue, 2.9% more than is expected to come in this fiscal year. Revenue in eight of the first 9 months of fiscal 2026 came in above benchmark, Mitchlewitz said, adding that the state's $8 billion rainy day fund gives us a little bit of comfort in what is difficult, uneasy times. I don't know if we would be as comfortable moving forward with a supplemental budget if we didn't have such a strong rainy day fund already there to protect us in case we have potential challenges or issues down the road, Mitchellwitz said. Mitchellwitz said pulling from the state stabilization fund would be an option should the income tax cut pass. As of the end of fiscal year 2025, the stabilization fund had a balance of $8.1 billion, according to a state financial report. That was down from $8.5 billion a year earlier, after lawmakers authorized the Healey administration to use interest earned on the fund for grant-matching purposes and to pay down state debt. "Everything always has to be on the table," Mitchellwitz said. "If we're talking about a $5 billion cut to our revenue sources through this ballot initiative, yeah, you have to kind of to weather the storm. Yeah, pulling from the rainy day fund would certainly have to be one of the things that would be discussed as an option." Lawmakers throughout negotiations will also have to address FIFA World Cup funding, for which the House has proposed $10 million and the Senate has proposed none. The House's figure would bring the legislature's funding for the matches and summer events up to $20 million. The proposal no longer includes $300 million in Group Insurance Commission funding. That was separated out from the larger bill, passed by lawmakers and signed by Governor Maura Healey in early April, before the GIC ran out of money. Conferees adjourned after an almost five-minute meeting. Senator Joe Comerford is also a conferee, but was not present Thursday. A second Massachusetts liberal arts college this month has announced it will close, underscoring the mounting financial strain facing small tuition-dependent schools. Anna Maria College in Paxton said Thursday that it will shutter at the end of the semester after what officials described as an exhaustive review of its finances. The decision follows a similar announcement earlier this month from Hampshire College in Amherst. Like many small tuition-dependent institutions, Anna Maria has faced structural challenges driven by declining enrollment and rising costs in the years following the pandemic, the college said in a statement. School officials pointed to a series of cost-cutting and revenue efforts over the past year, including reducing staffing and operating expenses by more than $2 million, resetting enrollment targets, and pursuing new income streams. While the college reported signs of improvement, including a 7.5% increase in spring enrollment and stronger-than-expected fundraising, its most recent audit raised significant concerns about its long-term viability. That audit included a going concern qualification, signaling substantial doubt about the college's ability to continue operating. The designation led to new restrictions on its administration of federal financial aid, compounding existing pressures. Combined with a financial assessment and risk monitoring notice from the Massachusetts Department of Higher Education and additional scrutiny from its accreditor, the New England Commission of Higher Education, officials said there was no viable path forward. Founded in 1946 by the Sisters of St. Anne as a women's college, Anna Maria later became coeducational and operated for decades as a private Catholic liberal arts institution. The Board of Trustees reached this decision only after pursuing every realistic alternative. "We are heartbroken," Board Chair David Trainer said in a statement. "The legacy of the Sisters of St. Anne and of every faculty member and staff person who carried their spirit forward will endure in every graduate this institution has ever produced." Graduating seniors will be able to complete their degrees and participate in commencement, while other students will be offered transfer pathways through agreements with partner institutions. The college said it will host transfer fairs both on campus and virtually. Anna Maria's closure reflects a broader accelerating trend in Massachusetts and across the country, where small liberal arts colleges are struggling to adapt to shifting demographics and economic realities. A shrinking pool of college-age students, increased competition from larger universities and online programs, and growing skepticism about the cost of a degree have put sustained pressure on enrollment, the primary revenue source for many of these institutions. In recent years, a number of similarly sized colleges have merged, cut programs, or shut down altogether. For schools with limited endowments and heavy reliance on tuition, even short-term dips in enrollment or unexpected financial constraints can quickly become existential threats, leaving administrators with few options beyond consolidation or closure. Constitutional separation of power issues have been central to the dispute over auditor Diana DeSoglio's attempt to audit the legislature, but now the auditor is the one raising concerns about one branch of government intruding upon another. If Attorney General Andrea Campbell's motion to strike the lawsuit DeSoglio brought against top Beacon Hill Democrats in February is allowed, it would prevent the judiciary from resolving the stalemate and substitute the judgment of the Attorney General, part of the executive branch, a brief that DeSoglio's office submitted to the Supreme Judicial Court Wednesday night argued. The High Court will hear arguments on the motion to strike May 6th. The 81-page document was written by attorney Shannon Liss Riordan, who ran against Campbell in 2022 and is slated to deliver oral arguments before the SJC in 2 weeks on DeSoglio's behalf. The filing seems to flip a core contention of top lawmakers that DeSoglio's quest to probe the legislature would violate constitutional separation of powers. Even if the Attorney General herself adopts the position that the legislative audit is unconstitutional or unenforceable, permitting her to block litigation based on these concerns would essentially allow her to be the final arbiter regarding these constitutional issues, rather than the judiciary, the brief states. Campbell is seeking to dismiss DeSoglio's complaint by arguing the AG's office is the only legal gatekeeper for interbranch governmental disagreements that may require court intervention. As Campbell sees it, DeSoglio's legal strategy could undermine the role of the AG's office. Campbell maintains that her office hasn't received sufficient information from DeSoglio to make the decision about representing her in a suit against the legislature, but she insists she is still open to the possibility. In the new filing, DeSoglio's office says Campbell has acted arbitrarily and capriciously by repeatedly asking the same questions about the audit's scope for more than a year, blocked her access to the courts, and defied public interest by not enforcing the law after 72% of voters backed the audit. By unilaterally precluding the auditor from accessing the courts and not defending the law of the Commonwealth in court, nor authorizing the auditor to retain a special assistant attorney general to enforce the law, the attorney general has acted in dereliction of her duty to represent the public interest and in violation of constitutional principles, the brief says. Campbell's actions have effectively rendered the People's Democratic Initiative a dead letter, the brief says. It urges the SJC to deny Campbell's motion and allow for a special assistant attorney general to be named. Used to controlling how laws get made on Beacon Hill, lawmakers are frustrated with the initiative petition process and are expressing interest in changing it in ways that may make it more arduous for citizen reformers. Those who are paying now for signature gatherers, those who are flooding the airways, are really kind of perverting what the process is supposed to be, said Representative Michael Day of Stoneham, a Joint Committee on Initiative Petitions member, referring to the 1918 law that allows voters to create laws through ballot initiatives. Campaigns backing initiative petitions must meet signature collection requirements to move their proposal forward. The first-round requirement is equal to 3% of the votes cast for governor in the most recent gubernatorial election. This election cycle, that was 74,574, according to the Secretary of State's office. If the legislature takes no action on an initiative petition before the May 5th deadline, campaigns must gather another 12,429 signatures, equal to 0.5% of votes cast in the latest gubernatorial election. No more than 25% of signatures can come from the same county. Day and other lawmakers argue that paid signature collectors undermine the intention behind the collection requirement. They say it's meant to be a high enough threshold to show there is enough support among voters for a proposed law that circumvents the normal legislative process. Proponents of ballot initiatives say signature gatherers are crucial to getting the signatures needed to get their issues on the ballot. Also, campaigns backing ballot initiatives say they wouldn't be pursuing ballot questions if the legislature took action on the issues their initiatives address. I guess what the bigger question for us as a legislature is what to do with this. Because the process is no longer what it was back in 1916, Day said during an initiative petition committee hearing on two tax-related ballot initiatives in March. For better or worse, we're looking at these kinds of paid drives to get out there and get on the ballot to circumvent where we are. In response, Jim Sturgios, executive director of Pioneer Institute and proponent of the tax-related initiative petitions, requested to ask Day a question. Committee co-chair Senator Cindy Freeman said, "No, we ask the questions." Sturgio shared his questions with the news service. One of them was whether the original intention behind law establishing the ballot initiative process, to empower voters to make laws when the legislature fails to act, still applies. "Aren't we seeing precisely those conditions today?" Sturgio said. There have been rumblings on Beacon Hill surrounding reforms of the initiative petition for decades that have grown louder recently as a record number of 12 are making their way to the 2026 ballot. This is up from 5 in 2024. And would exceed the record of 9 reached in 1972, 1976, and 1994, according to the Secretary of State's website. Senate President Karen Spilka and House Speaker Ron Mariano have made it clear they share other lawmakers' concerns with the initiative petition process. Governor Moore Healey has outwardly opposed specific initiative petitions and remained on the sidelines when it comes to reforming the process. When asked during a March 22nd appearance on Keller and Large if she shared Mariano and Spilka's reservations with the process, Healey said it's there for people to exercise and to use. Harold Hubschman, founder and president of the prominent signature-gathering firm SignatureDrive.com, said campaigns rely on paid signature gatherers because it's extremely difficult to advance their petitions otherwise. He said very few citizens in Massachusetts could collect the required 74,574 signatures without funding. Hubschman believes the process has worked well overall in Massachusetts, noting 90% of paid signature gatherers since 2009 worked for him. But if lawmakers want to keep money out of a ballot initiative campaigns, Hubschman suggested slashing the requirement down to a quarter of what it currently is. "People hire us not because they have money. People hire us because it's hard to do," Hubschman said. If they were genuinely concerned about the process being more egalitarian and more open to the public, they need to make it easier, not harder, to get on the ballot. The Senate approved a bill in January to require more public reporting on ballot question fundraising and spending. Mariano has indicated the House plans to take it up. A matching House bill is pending in the House Ways and Means Committee. An amendment to the bill from Senator Barry Feingold, who is on the Initiative Petitions Committee, prohibits ballot campaigns from offering rewards based on the number of signatures a gatherer collects, like a paper-signature arrangement. During the Senate season, Feingold noted the amendment is intended to prevent fraud in the signature-gathering process. Hubschman has no problem with the bill's disclosure requirements, but he balked at the idea of banning paper-signature agreements, saying similar measures were deemed unconstitutional in other states. The 26 states that allow initiative or referendum petitions have varying laws surrounding paid signature gatherers. 10 states ban paper signature arrangements, and Massachusetts is one of 16 states that allow them, according to Ballotpedia, a nonprofit online political encyclopedia. Courts have offered conflicting opinions. Records show federal courts have struck down laws banning paper signature arrangements in states including Washington and Ohio, finding they violate the First Amendment. Meanwhile, in 2023, the Arizona Supreme Court have upheld a law banning per-signature payments in the state, per Associated Press reporting. And in 2006, an appeals court upheld an Oregon law banning paper signature collections. Day has also suggested that the Attorney General should assess whether an initiative petition is constitutional when she certifies proposals. Currently, the Attorney General is charged with certifying initiative petitions based on a limited set of criteria outlined in the Constitution. His idea comes as lawmakers and auditor Diana DiZoglio have been feuding over a 2024 voter-approved audit law. Lawmakers have raised constitutionality concerns with the voter law, while DiZoglio has argued it offers much-needed transparency. The Senate has also taken an unusual step, seeking the Supreme Judicial Court's opinion on the constitutionality of two initiative petitions that would subject the legislature and governor's office to public records law and overhaul how legislative stipends are structured. Friedman said she wasn't sure the legislature could give the Attorney General the authority to rule on the constitutionality of a proposed law. The Arlington Democrat, who has expressed similar reservations as her colleagues with the process, remained tight-lipped about specific reforms to the process, saying lawmakers have to determine what they can do under the Constitution. "I think we're all going to be looking at what more we can do," Friedman said, "because it really is not so much the number of ballot questions. I mean, I wish there weren't so many, but I understand that. But it's just the way that the process is being used that is so deeply concerning." Massachusetts lawmakers aren't alone in their itching to reform the ballot initiative process. In 1 month at the start of the year, more than 65 bills aimed at reforming the ballot process were filed across the country, according to the Fairness Project, a group that supports initiative petitions. The group tracked 148 bills across 15 legislatures in 2025, and found the volume of legislation aimed at ballot measures has risen by 95% since 2023. Many of the reforms were taking place in Republican states like North Dakota, South Dakota, Florida, and Utah, where voters are fed up with one-party control, per the New York Times reporting. A recently enacted law in Florida, which already had some of the strictest prerequisites for ballot initiatives, added a host of new requirements, fees, and penalties surrounding signature collections. As a result, all of the 22 initiative petitions proposed this year failed to qualify for the ballot. As Bay State lawmakers are assessing whether to take action on this year's ballot initiatives, the renewed push to reform the process, alongside the sudden rise in ballot initiatives, signals growing tensions between voters and their elected officials. Charlie Barker says college sports can help colleges navigate declining enrollment and financial strain. Speaking in Boston on Thursday, the former Massachusetts governor and current president of the National Collegiate Athletic Association linked athletic success to increased visibility and student interest, while acknowledging broader structural challenges affecting colleges and universities nationwide. Asked about the salaries of University of Massachusetts coaches, which regularly place among the highest for public employees in the state, Baker said those decisions are made at the campus level, but added that athletics can contribute to an institutional identity. Coach pay is a decision for the chancellor and the board, Baker told reporters after speaking to the Boston College Chief Executives Club. I do believe that sports can play a big role in creating brand. He continued, when the UMass hockey team won the national championship a few years ago, it created, I remember talking to Chancellor Subbaswamy at the time, and he said it really bumped our admissions in a pretty big way. Baker said similar patterns have played out at other institutions where high-profile athletic success can lead to increased interest from prospective students. I actually think part of the reason people are spending money on sports, in many cases, is because sports build brand and brand matters, he said. If you look at the things that some schools have done with their athletic programs to create brand and visibility in applications, he said, High Point, they beat Wisconsin in the second round of the NCAA tournament. They got 19,000 requests the next day for student business. His comments came as higher education institutions face multiple pressures, including declining numbers of college-age students, shifting perceptions about the value of a degree, and growing competition from alternative education pathways. The biggest challenge everybody in higher education is going to have is there just aren't as many kids as there used to be, Baker said. My oldest, who's now 34, was part of the largest group of 18-year-olds ever, and that number has been going down every year since then, and is expected to keep going down for a long time. He pointed out that online learning options and other non-traditional pathways have expanded in recent years, contributing to changes in how students approach higher education. There's also been a fair amount of conversation about what's the plus-minus of a college education relative to choosing other paths, Baker said. The online opportunities around education are far bigger than they've ever been. Baker said institutions should assess their strengths and focus resources accordingly, including decisions about athletics programs. There are a bunch of schools that leverage their success in athletics to serve their academic mission in extraordinary ways, he said. I think every school is different. I think people need to think real hard about what they think they can be great at, whatever it might be, and then they need to focus on that. Though now speaking as the head of college athletics, Baker's experience is also informed by overseeing higher education issues as governor. He held that office during an era when several small private colleges in Massachusetts closed or faced financial distress. The 2018 closure of Mount Ida College drew statewide attention, and the trend has continued. This month, Hampshire College announced plans to close, highlighting ongoing challenges for smaller institutions. Baker also addressed the regulatory environment surrounding college athletics, pointing to the need for clearer rules. If I could have one thing, it would probably be some narrow provision that would make it possible for us to put rules in place that could stick, he said, responding to a question about regulatory or legislative changes he would seek from Congress in an ideal world. And when I say that, I mean things like academic eligibility period. We have all kinds of folks trying to get a 6th, 7th, and 8th year. They don't get it from us, and then they go get it from the judge who graduated from their school. No offense to judges, he said. Baker said changes could help create certainty and stability. A lot of the stuff I would look for is not that dramatic, he said, but it would make a huge difference with respect to creating certainty and stability, which are two things I know higher ed folks care a lot about. You've been listening to an episode of the Massachusetts State House News Service, a program produced by Audio Journal and sponsored by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. This is Paula Simchak. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for more informative programming by Audio Journal.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Are you a senior who is dealing with vision loss? Would you like to learn about advocacy efforts on behalf of seniors who are blind? And about support calls, where you can talk with other seniors who are also dealing with vision loss? If so, join us, the Alliance on Aging and Vision Loss, an affiliate of the American Council of the Blind. To learn more, visit our website, www.aavl.com. www.blind-seniors.org.